Hey everybody, it's another episode of Propagandos. My microphone is not working. This is Connor, joined by Alec. This is a bit of a solo episode, but we wanted to introduce it as a duo. I got the honor and privilege to interview Dr. Tori Olson at the University of Tennessee. He is a historian that focuses on post-Civil War history in the American South. And he wrote a book about Red Dead Redemption and Red Dead Redemption 2. And it kind of debunks some of the mythologies and delves into the history that the game is attempting to portray at the turn of the 20th century. And it was a great conversation. Alec, I wish you could have joined me. Are you a big fan of these games?
I have not played these games. So, okay.
That's why you were not a part of this.
I know of Red Dead Redemption 2. I've seen like some of the cutscenes and I know some of the themes. So like I think it's pretty fascinating. So I hadn't even considered this, that so many people that played this game, for a lot of them, some of the concepts might be brand new to them, right? And as a piece of media, right? And like I think Dr. Olson basically says like the vibe of the game is pretty historically accurate, right? The vibe, not every detail, you know, all the names are changed and all that, but certainly like they've made some editorial decisions and a lot of people resonate with that. And the thing that's like interesting is, as like a piece of medium, right, like the video games art stuff notwithstanding, you can have that argument forever, but like Rockstar games are art. They're like phenomenal art, and like the level of engagement that you get as a teacher, right, if this game, outside of being fun, right, is a teaching moment, just the way GTA is, right? A series of games I have played. If they're that fun, and you probably actually come away with some kind of historical understanding of like a particular American period, that's like astonishing. There's so much more, like, there's so much more that you can do with like 100-hour immersive story. How long is the game, Connor? Is it maybe that's overstated.
It's like to fully complete it, it's like 80 hours. I've logged over 200 hours in this game.
Jesus Christ! Well, like 80 hours—that's 40 movies worth of content, mm-hmm. right? That you're like personally invested in. I mean, some of it you're skinning beavers or whatever, right? But like, but you get the vibe of a place, and I don't know if that's even really, I don't even know if that level can be portrayed in like other media. It's just so much. Anyway, I think it's fascinating from, you know, teaching perspective, propaganda perspective, if you want to talk about like the politics it portrays. And I think the app's great. I wish I'd been on it, but you know, the professors, they want to record in the middle of the day. They don't want to go after hours.
That's true. It was a lunch break record, and they're getting harder and harder to pull off now that you're a working man.
Unfortunate, yeah. Indeed.
So anyway, some other announcements we have. We officially have a Discord now. You will be able to find a link to that in the show notes for this episode. Join our Discord. Let's keep the conversation going. No, I think this will be a great way for us to talk with our listeners and, you know, point out some propaganda things that we haven't been paying attention to, and just discuss some episode. We anticipate maybe 13 of y'all will be hopping into this thing.
A couple of them are already in there because they were the ones asking for the Discord. So.
Yeah. So be nice to us. Be nice to each other. And we are cooking up some pretty cool content coming up. We've got a couple of collabs on the back burner right now. So we're excited. We're excited for the future of Propagandos and to finish out the rest of the year. You know, we update twice a month, so you're looking at least 5 more episodes.
We have to make 5 more episodes this year.
Minimum. We got to make 5 more of these fucking things.
Nah, we're having fun. Yeah. I love it.
Okay. Well, do you have anything to add, Alec?
No.
All right.
Roll that tape, boy.
Dr. Tori Olson is an American history professor at the University of Tennessee. and the author of the new book, Red Dead's History, A Video Game, An Obsession, and America's Violent Past, which explores the historical truth behind the Red Dead Redemption games. Dr. Olson, thank you for joining me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Connor. I'm looking forward to talking about the book and big ideas.
Great. So let's start off. The thing that I really loved about your book was the structure of it. For our listeners who have not read it, Dr. Olson basically writes a series of historical vignettes, which each chapter focusing on one particular aspect of American history. So the topics of the chapters range from the expansion of the American railroad system to the rise of Confederate statues to the Hatfield-McCoy feud. If you find one chapter particularly interesting, you can go to the extensive reference section to find more information. I think it's a great way to structure the book, and I am likely going to rip it off one day, but I wanted to know how you came to settle on that method. This is me just trying to figure out how to eventually write a propaganda book with my co-host, Alec.
Right on. Well, yeah, thanks for the question and for having me. So I don't know if I can really talk about the structure of the book without saying a little something about how this book came about, right? Because this is a very unusual book. It's a book about American history by a history professor, but it uses this insanely popular video game as the sort of jumping off point to explore that history. So for you to understand the organization, which is regional and then thematic, right? So it begins in the American West and then continues into the Deep South and then moves into Southern Appalachia. And then within each of those geographic sections, you have sort of topical thematic sections on, you know, big institutions or events in that region's history. So the short story of how this came to be, because this is a kind of experimental and wacky project, let's be honest, right? I mean, if you told me 5 years ago that this would be my second book, I would laugh at you. You know, this was not something I could have seen coming, but it is part of my personal history in a certain way. So I am, of course, a history professor now at the University of Tennessee, but before I became an academic, I was just a regular kid growing up in 1990s America. And as that kid, what I really loved was video games. I mean, it was like my high school hobby, my passion, my overwhelming obsession. It dictated what I did during much of my daily routine during the 1990s. You know, this is kind of a golden era of PC gaming, especially. And I was just bound to my screen and mouse and keyboard playing Quake and Half-Life and Warcraft and Starcraft and all that stuff, right? This is before I was like an academic. You know, in fact, I was a terrible student in high school. I will confess that I squeaked out of high school with a 2.7 GPA. No one would have anticipated that I was headed for university professorship at that point, to be sure. But the reason, in fact, why I quit video games, which I did the year that I started college, right after high school, is because I recognized, you know, like that this child, the sort of, you know, adolescent obsession of mine was not going to let me do well in college. So I quit gaming in 2000, and I literally took 20 years off from playing video games. So for the next two decades, while I was in college, while I went to graduate school, while I began as an assistant professor, I did basically no gaming whatsoever. I just assumed that this was a you know, childhood frivolity that I had grown out of, and now I was an adult and would never return to that, you know, passion ever again. And in an alternate universe, that may well have happened, but the universe that we live in struck us with COVID-19 in 2020. And as a result of the pandemic, I decided in the early weeks of lockdown to dip my toes back into gaming just for fun, right? I mean, I did this just purely as a hobby, as a way to pass the time in the pandemic. And one of the first games that I played was Red Dead Redemption 2, which is this game from 2018 that's historical in that it's set in a fictionalized America of 1899. And as it turns out, this is like the time period that I'm an expert at. I'm a specialist in post-Civil War American history. And I find myself playing this game for fun, but soon it becomes more than that. Because as I'm playing this game, remember, this is like the first game I've really played since I was like a teenager, and I'm definitely not a teenager anymore. I was playing it for fun, but I was also playing it as a professional historian. And the historian in me, I mean, the gamer in me loved the game, right? Because I'm like, wow, the graphics are amazing. You know, this is a massive open world game. It's so brilliantly crafted. The historian in me, as I was playing the game, was also impressed, but for very different reasons. And to be honest, I had quite low expectations going into this game, in part because most blockbuster pop culture products that do history usually do a pretty bad job with them. They rely on a lot of stereotype and cliche and sort of mythology. And of course, there's some of that in Red Dead Redemption 2 as well. But I was pretty genuinely surprised and impressed at how often this video game, which, you know, by that point had been played by dozens and dozens of millions of people, how often this game would actually gesture at some of the very biggest dilemmas in American history, the kinds of things that historians teach when we teach the so-called Gilded Age and Progressive Era, the kind of like 1870s through 1920s moment that I think the Red Dead series captures so well. I was shocked to see the games, you know, talking about women's suffrage in the Deep South, corporate capitalism in the West and in Appalachia, the conflicted memory of the Civil War in the 1880s and 1890s. Like, those are topics that usually don't make it into video games. This was quite surprising to me. And especially when the game moved into the southern parts of the United States, the game begins in the West, and then eventually kind of, you know, as the storyline progresses, moves into the Deep South, this fictional state of Lemoyne, which I imagine to be a sort of composite of Louisiana and Mississippi. And with the central city of Saint-Denis being an obvious New Orleans, once the game started moving into the South, and I'm primarily a Southern historian, I mean, I know my Western history too, but, you know, I was very much trained in the history of the South. Once I saw, like, you know, how rich a lot of the depictions, not all, I mean, some of them are, you know, not great, but how there's a good number of, you know, serious topics that are raised in the game, I had this epiphany of, well, why don't I try teaching a class, an undergraduate class, that would build on the enthusiasm and excitement that so many students have for this game, and then use it as a springboard to actually teach real American history. That was my basic idea, right? This is the fall of 2020. By that point, I'd completed the single player game, and I came up with this wild idea to teach a class that I called Red Dead America, the real history behind the hit video games. And I pitched it to my hires up in the history department, who, by the way, had never heard of Red Dead Redemption 2 or any of those games, because let's be honest, most historians have not. Most historians are not gamers, which is fine. They don't need to be. But they knew I would do a serious job with it, that it wouldn't become Red Dead Fan Club. That was never my intention. So they gave me permission to try it for the first time. So in fall of 2021, I'm very proud to say that I taught the world's first ever college history class using the Red Dead Redemption games as a way to explore the very real history, particularly of violence in the United States in the kind of 1870 to 1920 period. And the class was a big success, both in the sense that it was very well enrolled, a lot of students signed up for it, and also success in that students were really enthusiastic about talking about actual history. You know, they were enthusiastic to talk about the game, but they would all find that we actually didn't talk about the game that much. I mean, I would begin every class session with some sort of link to the game, but the majority of the class was, you know, fairly traditional history course that had exams and papers and readings and lectures and all that sort of stuff. But because of the hook of the games, I saw, you know, I witnessed a sort of level of enthusiasm and willingness to, you know, talk about big stuff that sometimes you have to squeeze out of students in a comparable non-video game related class. So after I finished teaching the class in, you know, late 2021, I had the idea that I imagine that there were lots of gamers and history buffs around the world who were not students at the University of Tennessee, but might be interested in kind of, you know, following the journey that I'd taken my students on. So there came the idea of writing a book based on the class. And for the past several years, I've been working on that book, adapting a lot of the lectures and discussions from the class into a readable and engaging book that's really aimed at, you know, regular folks. Like, it's not aimed at academics. I mean, I happy if academics read it or use it to teach, but it's not really, it's aimed at a general audience. And I wrote it in hopefully such a way that it would be accessible and fun, while also, you know, serious and eye-opening exploration of, you know, big questions in American history. So basically, is a very long-winded answer, Connor, to your original question. The structure of the book really matches onto the structure of the class. So the class, I also divided our semester up into geographical units. The only difference between the class and the book is that I did have a unit on Mexico and the Mexican Revolution, which used Red Dead, the original Red Dead Redemption game, quite heavily, since it goes to Mexico in 1911. But yeah, we begin in the West. So the class kind of follows the storyline of Red Dead 2, which begins in the West, moves into the Deep South. Yes, there's a part in the Caribbean, which I actually don't talk about much in my class or in my book. I get into that later on why. And then into Southern Appalachia, like the Eastern mountains. So it was really a byproduct of the class, which also was a sort of, you know, homage to the storyline of Red Dead Redemption 2.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the pop culture kind of simplifying history. So one of the reasons why I wanted you on this podcast in particular is Alec and I, my co-host, we look at propaganda through like kind of a pop cultural lens. Like we've come a long way from Triumph of the Will or Uncle Sam Wants You. And, you know, you can, for those listening now, you can listen to our episode on the new Ronald Reagan biopic on how pop culture can really simplify history and erases historical context and really leans on mythologies, historical mythologies. And one of the mythologies that you mentioned in your book is this idea of American identity being rooted in our quote unquote taming of the American frontier, an idea not created but heavily popularized by Frederick Jackson Turner's lecture, The Significance of the Frontier in American History. Now, this idea, as you point out, certainly seems to form the basis of the Wild West, or the idea of the Wild West, and serves as the backbone for the near totality of the Western genre, with a couple of exceptions, you know, some subversions of that. And I wanted to know if you could speak more on the impact of that one sparsely attended lecture and the impact it had on American history.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. So it's like, it's a speech that's definitely in the top three most influential things that any historian of the United States has ever said. But no one would have guessed it at the time, right? Because it happens in 1893. And it's, as Connor mentioned, this address by this very junior historian. Like I currently am older than Frederick Jackson Turner was when he delivered that address. He was like early mid 30s or something. You know, he was a pretty unknown guy. He was a professor at the University of Wisconsin. He's from Wisconsin. But the moment when he gives the speech is really fascinating because it comes during pretty much the biggest World's Fair that had, as far as I can tell, had been put on at that moment. It's the 1893 World's Columbian Exposition. And this was like a months-long celebration, mainly of the 400-year anniversary of Columbus landing in the Americas. Now you might think, you know, wouldn't that have been 1892? I think the conference, the event organizers had trouble getting their shit together, and they had to, you know, postpone it by a little bit. But it was meant to, you know, celebrate 1492, hence the Columbian Exposition, and it's hosted in Chicago. And Chicago is a, you know, opportune place to host this big celebration because Chicago was like the big boom town of the late 1800s. I don't think it wasn't the largest city in the United States, but it was the most rapidly growing one at that time. And it was the sort of westernmost massive city and represented a sort of burgeoning American industrial imperial might at the time. So at this fair, there's all these big unveilings of new technologies and new products. The Ferris wheel, for example, makes its debut at the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. The zipper, Cracker Jack popcorn, and my own personal favorite is that it's in 1893 at this fair. It's a beer contest. There's a brewing competition, and the winner of it was a brewery called Pabst. They won the blue ribbon in this competition, and hence we have the Pabst Blue Ribbon beer. So literally, like now, 130 years later, they're literally still like patting themselves on the back for what the award that they won at the 1893 Chicago Columbian Exposition. So there's all of this glitz and glamour, you know, like fireworks, oohs and ahs going on. But then in the midst of it, the American Historical Association, the AHA, which is this professional organization of historians that had been founded just a few years earlier, they decide to have their conference hosted sort of in conjunction with the fair. It was actually off, right off of the fairgrounds, so it wasn't, you know, technically part of the formal fair, but it was meant to, you know, coincide with it and speak to similar themes. Now, this was way less popular of an event than the Ferris wheel and the Pabst Blue Ribbon, I promise you that, right? So, like, it's a rather stuffy, buttoned-up event. All these historians come together, and basically all the other lectures have been forgotten, consigned to the dustbin of history. No one really remembers any other address, at least I don't, about it. But there's one that becomes hugely influential, right? So this is Frederick Jackson Turner, this young, you know, unlikely guy to give this memorable address. But he lays out in his, like, I don't know exactly how long the talk was, but it wasn't particularly long. I think it was about 20, 30 minutes or so. Lays out his vision for, like, what's the real story of American history? Like, what is the defining characteristic of the United States and its past? And he argues that it's not the slavery dispute, which many historians saw as the central question, right? I mean, this is just a, you know, a few decades after the Civil War. It's not the transplanting of European institutions on American soil. This is another big sort of identity explanation that other historians had given. What defined the United States and its history was this series of Western expansions, that it was a sort of repeating cycle of westering, of as white, mainly male protagonists that he sees, white English-speaking men, you know, in this sort of repeating cycle of taming a Western wilderness that begins in a sort of, you know, Appalachian Mountains, moves into the Ohio River Valley, moves into the Great Plains, moves into the Rockies. Like, the, every generation, you have this renewed cycle of Western settlement. This is his basic argument, you know, that this cycle is what defines the American character. And he's also there with a kind of worrisome message that this was coming to an end. So he pinpoints 1890. He says 1890 is the year when the Western expansion no longer defines the American character. So he sees a sort of closing of the West, a taming of the West. And of course, many gamers have probably never heard of Frederick Jackson Turner, but if they've played Red Dead Redemption 2, they know this narrative, because, like, the splash screen text that opens Red Dead 2 is precisely drawn from Turner. I mean, like, I don't know if it was explicitly done so, because there's so many, you know, movies and TV shows and literature that's recycled the same idea since then. But the basic idea of Red Dead 2 is that, you know, the period of openness and chaos in the West is coming to an end. This suffocating corporate order is arriving to the region, and, you know, things will never be the same. And this one outlaw gang, the Vanderlyn gang, is trying to sort of, you know, pry open the frontier and keep that, you know, untamed spirit alive. So even though Frederick Jackson Turner does not show up in the credits of Red Dead Redemption 2, maybe he should, because this narrative is really central to it, right? So, and it all started in 1893 with that address that he gave at this big World's Fair.
Yeah. Religion does not seem to play a huge role for the majority, overwhelming majority of the characters in this game. There's a nun that you can help out with some side quests, and there's a turtle worshiping cult called the Chelonians that you encounter once.
Reverend Swanson.
Yes, that's right.
He's not much of a, you know, yeah. I don't see him as a real man of the cloth. He's mainly drunk during most of the game.
Yeah. Now, I was under the impression that Americans were deeply religious during the time period that's portrayed in this game, the turn of the 20th century. Am I wrong in believing this? And do you think the game squandered an opportunity to explore that facet of American life?
Sure. Yeah. You know, it's actually a great point that I don't raise in my book, but I probably should have, because one of the defining features of American identity was, you know, religiosity in a whole range of religions, right? I mean, yeah, there were, you know, Protestants of various stripes, but then there's lots and lots of Catholics, lots of Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, all sorts of people, right? But like, and these religions, you know, were profoundly, just like today, profoundly meaningful to many people and often divided folks from one another. I mean, you know, the American working class, for example, was famously torn in these fights between Protestants and Catholics and Jews. And these were live wire questions, but they basically don't exist in Red Dead 2, which is, you're right, it's a big absence. You know, it's something I need to add to my list of like towering institutions that are completely absent from Red Dead Redemption 2. And to me, as I've been thinking about it, the two that I think about most frequently is party politics on one hand, and then the labor movement on the other hand. Like these are two, alongside religion, party politics and a labor movement were like, again, towering features of American life in the 1890s. It would have been impossible to understand American society if those were whisked away. Yet, of course, in Red Dead 2, they are basically non-existent. So the game would have been far richer had the developers and writers, you know, spent more time trying to get that in there. But, you know, I understand why they dodged those issues, but it does detract from the potential, you know, accuracy or thoughtfulness of the games. But yeah, you're right. Religion belongs there too.
Maybe Red Dead Redemption 3 will be about the Mormon trips from Missouri to Utah. Maybe that's what will come down the pipeline.
Maybe.
I doubt Rockstar would actually do a Mormon take, but we'll see.
Yeah, who knows? Yeah. I mean, it's very interesting to me seeing the maturation of Red Dead Redemption from Red Dead 1 to Red Dead 2. Because I've played both of them at this point. I've played a lot more of the second game, to be sure, which I do think is a much smarter and more historically nuanced and thoughtful game. But as I see it, in the first game, the only characters who really have like texture and complexity are white men. Like it's just a nod. I mean, maybe the rancher's daughter. She has a little bit of character, but most of the other like characters, like the non-white characters, the female characters, are just flat stereotypes. Like they're parodies, essentially. But Red Dead 2 is very different, right? Because yes, the protagonist remains a white man in the second game, but he's surrounded by really interesting and complex female, non-white, immigrant, you know, characters from all over. And they are so much, you know, more interesting and so much more defying of stereotype than the sort of, you know, hackneyed characters of Red Dead 1.
Yeah. Now I'm going to
say, you never know what direction they're going to take the next game. I have no clue. That's maybe true. It will be about, you know, religion is central. It's set in the 1840s. I have no idea.
So I'm going to pivot the rest of this interview to more philosophical existential things. But when okay. I was reading the sections about the absolutely malicious destruction of Appalachia, I found my jaw dropping, thinking, how could we have destroyed such beautiful territory? I've driven through the Carolinas and it's just absolutely gorgeous. But I caught myself when I remembered we're still doing environmental self-harm through offshore drilling and fracking. Now, excuse me if this is too much of a philosophical question, but why are humans or Americans so resistant to learning from and remembering their history?
Well, I think some people are quite interested in learning their history. I think that the sort of, I don't want to sound too conspiracy theory-ish here, but like, you know, the powers behind Madison Avenue and Hollywood, like the advertising and media industries, it's not to their benefit to have Americans engage with all of their history, because a lot of American history is quite radical. It's the history of grassroots resistance, of critiques of capitalism, of solidarity across multiple class and racial lines. About it's a very different story than sometimes we recall and remember. So consider this, like the 1870s and 80s is a moment when, and the 1890s too, to some extent, that's a moment when corporate capitalism is new, like something that's profoundly, people are unfamiliar with, that's unprecedented in its arrival, you know, that sort of unprecedented size and scale of these new corporations. These are things you and I, Connor, are familiar with because we've grown up in an America where, you know, the Fortune 500 and the Wall Street elites, you know, dominate so much of life, you know, Amazon and Walmart and Apple and all these titans of the day. But that was totally new to a lot of Americans at the time. And tons of folks back then were really bitter and resistant toward this. They did not at all see the rise of, you know, big organized corporations as a positive development. They saw it as a grave threat, not just to economic equality, but in fact to political equality, to democracy. They saw large-scale, you know, corporate industrial enterprises as a fundamental threat to the ability of people to govern themselves. Because as people become, you know, led by these mega bosses and shape the direction, they can control their votes. They have such dominance that, you know, many folks saw democracy as kind of impossible in the shadow of these new corporate titans. And, you know, these are familiar questions today, right? Given the sort of power that money has in politics, shaping, you know, campaign financing and advertising, we're asking a lot of the same questions today. And I think if we dig back quite, you know, into the late 19th century, we find out that, you know, a lot of Americans were unwilling to accept this regime that, you know, most Americans today have kind of swallowed. So, you know, history, looking backward at the past, can be very troublesome. It can be very upsetting of the status quo, which is why I think, you know, there's a real sort of effort in the culture industries in the United States to kind of airbrush and whitewash what happened to this country. And to kind of assume, well, everyone always got along, you know, we were all in this together. Like, well, that actually wasn't true at all.
So Rockstar Games, the company behind Red Dead franchise, they've certainly put out some real success stories, from the Grand Theft Auto franchise to Bully. But the success that they've seen from Red Dead Redemption 2 is absolutely unprecedented for the company, for the entertainment industry, for the video game industry. I personally have beaten this game 3 times and it's full completion. I've logged nearly.
Hey, same with me. I've played it 3 times as well.
Oh man, I should write a book. It would be nowhere near as good as yours. I've logged like nearly 200 hours in this, and
I've also logged 200 hours in it.
Oh man, all right.
We're on exactly the same track. You should have beat me to the punch. You should have written this book, man.
Oh man.
I mean, there's a lot of gamers who played much more than 200 hours, I should say. And of course, to write a book about a game and its history, you don't just have to be a fan of the game. You got to know a lot of American history too. So, I mean, I know you're in graduate school and, you know, getting your training, but not in history per se.
No, I in fact, my historical knowledge could stand to be brushed up on. Reading your book,
let me ask you this. Yeah, so did you learn a lot of new stuff in that book?
I learned a lot. You know, I mean, I've grown up in the South. I'm from the Gulf Coast. I have family from Louisiana mostly. So, yeah. Of course, I did hear the Lost Cause narrative about the Civil War. I grew up absolutely thinking that the Civil War was fought over states' rights. And it wasn't until like in the past. It wasn't until in the past like 5 or 6 years that I've learned it. Nope, right. It was very much about slavery. Even my college courses glossed over
states' rights to own slaves.
Yeah, absolutely.
That dominated. That's great.
And the thing that I'm really learning most about, and we had an interview with Professor Brian Huberman about this, is that there had never really been a lot of historical work on like labor and the environment of the American West. And so just learning about the history of the labor movement, learning the hillbilly myth that you talk about in your book was astounding to me. You know, it's just the people in power have a habit of, are we exploiting someone? Let's make them out to look stupid. Let's make them out to look savage. Let's make them the other. And it's something that goes beyond racial lines. It's something that also goes into class lines. It's something that goes I want what you have. I drink your milkshake. Therefore, I make you out to be less than.
Yeah. No, the Appalachia stuff is fascinating, right? So I live in Southern Appalachia. You know, I live in East Tennessee. The Great Smoky Mountains National Park is just around the corner from my office where I'm standing right now. And even in this place, you know, a lot of folks native to the region have internalized this sort of, you know, hillbilly mythology that what defines this region is its sort of isolation and backwardness. And, you know, some people own, you know, wear it as a point of pride, you know, they're like, you know, hillbilly pride sort of thing. But it's, you know, the history of how this myth came to be is, as you mentioned, you know, is really eye-opening, and that it's totally fabricated to justify the exploitation and sort of, you know, siphoning of wealth out of this region, really in, at the very same moment that Red Dead Redemption 2 is set. In fact, the very first use of the word hillbilly is only in 1900 in the printed record. Like, we don't have any evidence that the word hillbilly ever appeared in print in the 1800s. It's only in 1900 that it first makes its debut. And then, of course, it's going to be printed and reprinted a million times during the 20th and the 21st century. But it's very much crafted to explain why big Northeastern corporations should be removing coal, lumber, you know, other minerals from the southern mountains and leaving very little wealth in return, right? It's because, oh, this is helping to integrate this region into America and ease the, you know, isolation of these supposed hillbillies. And the reality is that, no, this is what made them poor, right? Like, yeah. This extractive process is actually what created the conditions of poverty that would then, you know, reinforce the hillbilly myth later on. So it's crazy that a video game can somewhat help us get there. And I say somewhat because the game recycles a lot of cliches of Appalachia as well. But it also allowed me the opportunity to talk about the sort of fabrication of those, because the game does recognize that big external corporations were very active and were totally transforming Appalachia at the very moment when Arthur Morgan rides in, you know, so with like Leviticus Cornwall and his mining corporation, the Jameson Mining Company, right, which is, you know, a very similar thing is happening across Appalachia at that very moment in the 1890s.
Yeah. I don't know if you can speak to the term redneck, and if that's, I mean, I've heard different things about it. I've heard that it's really just about you work out in the field and you have, you know, a sunburn on your neck. But I've also heard that red bandanas were used by coal miners in America to show solidarity and class solidarity against corporations that owned coal mines.
You know, I don't know the precise etymology of the word. I know that there's probably a couple different channels that it's coming from, but I think it's, you know, primarily a class distinction of an agricultural laborer, though usually entailed for, you know, white agricultural laborers, given that there's lots of Black and, you know, Latino agricultural laborers as well. Yeah, it's a fascinating term, obviously, you know, it's loaded in so many ways. And, you know, Rockstar Games, like they do have a very long history of demeaning and mocking white rural people.
Yeah.
So we shouldn't exactly look to them for like enlightened views of this. And Red Dead 2 is the least bad. I've just recently been playing Grand Theft Auto 5, and it's like shocking how insulting their depictions of rural Americans are. In fact, I'm like surprised that there's not like a mass uprising of like controversy. I mean, those games get, they're the source of so much controversy, but I've heard much less about how they, you know, really demean and mock white rural people, especially poor white southern rural people, especially. And Red Dead 2 does a little bit of this, but it also allows me to kind of talk about the reality of, you know, how class operated in the late 1800s, which is quite fascinating.
I'm glad you pointed out that it you know, there's not much pushback on the portrayal of white rural southerners. Something that's really frustrating as a Texan is anytime there is a clamping down on reproductive health rights in the state that, you know, has national reverberation, there's a lot of things like, oh, nothing good ever happens from Texas, you know, fuck Texas. It's like, you know, we're actually doing a lot of work to secure our rights down here. And that often gets overlooked. Texas kind of has a reputation for being full of people who aren't, you know, doing the daily work that it takes to restore certain rights that are being stripped away from us. So,
anyway. Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm by no means an apologist for anything rural white Southerners have done. They have a pretty bad track record, but then again, white America in general has a pretty bad track record.
Yeah.
You know, the rural white South is not the exclusive, culprit of this.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I live in Tennessee. You know, I'm not from here. I'm from Sweden originally, and and grew up in Massachusetts. But I know, as you do too, Connor, that, you know, the supposed red states are actually really diverse and complex. Like, yeah. They're really, I mean, especially Texas, it's really a purple state. I mean, yeah, maybe Democrats haven't won a presidential election in some time there, but there's tons of so many political viewpoints on the ground. Not only are there lots and lots of, you know, people of color in these states who have very diverse political views, but even among white Tennesseans and Texans, there's a tremendous diversity. They're not all, you know, Trumpies to the heart. Like, it's a very different world than, you know, I mean, I grew up in Boston, you know, so I internalized a lot of mythology about what the South was like, you know, and that it all these stereotypes. And having lived there for 20 years, I've come to realize that it's way more complicated than that. There's a lot going on that sort of national myths don't allow for.
So in the interest of time, I'm going to skip ahead to some of my final questions here. I wanted to ask, is there anything about the Western genre in particular that you think evokes such a strong sense of nostalgia to the point of escapism, such as me playing Red Dead Redemption 2 for 200 hours?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, Western mythology is a century and a half old folk religion in the United States, especially adopted and embraced by white Americans, though not exclusively so. You know, non-whites have also, you know, adhered to this myth in certain ways, though they have definitely been more critical because of the obvious, you know, shortcomings of the sort of Frederick Jackson Turner story and the John Wayne Western, right, which leaves very little room for anyone but sort of, you know, white men as the heroes of this of these narratives. So I think it's, you know, it's a sort of national folk religion in a sense. And I think that's why when Red Dead Redemption 2 debuted, it was overwhelmingly marketed as and reviewed as a Western, as a cowboy epic, as a sort of, you know, Wild West game. But as you know, Connor, only about half of the game actually plays out in the West. Tons of the game is in the Deep South, in Appalachia, in Cuba or Guarma, some, you know, a fictional Caribbean island. And those are not Western locations at all. So why didn't they just market the game as kind of like Americana rather than a Western? Well, they know all too well that West sells and Appalachia does not, nor does, you know, like there are today, there is no longer established genres called Southerns and Caribbeans or Appalachians, right? But Westerns still hold this, you know, prominent place in so many people's imaginary. So that's what shocked me, right? I think I mentioned already that, like, you know, I started getting serious about teaching and writing about the game when I realized it was not just a Western. It was a whole lot more than that as well. And I think a lot of gamers must have been surprised thinking that they were in for a Western, which Red Dead 1, aside from its Mexican chapters, was very much, you know, set west of the Mississippi River. But Red Dead 2 is not. So I wonder what people made of that, you know, when they're like in Saint-Denis, you know, they're like in New Orleans and they're like, wow, this didn't show up in the trailer for the game. You know, what are we doing here? There's like factories and trolley cars and, you know, billowing smokestacks. This is not how I imagined a Western would be. It is. It defies that stereotype.
It's really, I'm really glad you pointed out that West sells, because, you know, there's so many neo-Westerns that are being released. Like, it's set in the contemporary day. They're driving cars. How is this a Western? So yeah, you got a really good point there. The only other franchise I can think of that ambitiously attempts to portray history are like the Assassin's Creed games. And I don't need a history degree to tell you that they take a lot of liberties with the source material.
Yeah.
What other games can you recommend to people who want to learn more history through the interactive medium of gaming?
Yeah. So I think one of the smartest games that speaks to history is a rather non-traditional one, because it's not set in an actual location on this planet, and it doesn't actually have any time stamp on it whatsoever in terms of chronological setting. But it's a game called Disco Elysium. Ooh. Do you know this game?
So
Disco Elysium is this, you know, it's like this dystopian detective thriller set in what's probably supposed to be Eastern Europe after the fall of communism. And it's made by an Estonian studio. And it's, first of all, a brilliant, hilarious, moving, touching, incredibly well-written game. But it really speaks to the sort of disillusionment that followed this utopian experiment of communism, which, of course, that's such gaping problems within it, in Eastern Europe especially. And it's so fascinating in the way that the game kind of lampoons these competing political philosophies that kind of come in the wake of communism, you know, whether it's anarchism or neoliberal capitalism or you name it. I mean, there's so much wiggle room in this game. But I'm not the person to teach this class, but someone very much could teach, you know, the kind of post-Soviet moment in Eastern Europe through it. And actually, one of my colleagues here at Tennessee is thinking about this, whether it'll become a class or not, I don't know. But it's a very smart game, right? I mean, it's much better writing even than Red Dead Redemption 2. It's just it's much more literary of a game, to be sure. I mean, it's almost closer to a visual novel than it is to, you know, traditional, you know, video game, to be sure. But yeah, so that's one that I would highlight. Yeah, I mean, I think that Assassin's Creed games are interesting. You know, they do less, they use more real names and places than Red Dead or any Rockstar game does, which of course leaves them open to more critique, because it's like, oh, well, you know, this is not at all what Baghdad looked like or whatever. Unfortunately for me, I'm not trained in any of the places and times that they're set in. There's only a handful of American ones, and they're all set in earlier periods in time. So I don't really have the expertise to critique them. The only one I've really played is the Mirage one, which is set in 9th century Baghdad. But, you know, I'm not an expert this time or place. I mean, I practically know nothing about this period. So I played that more as a gamer than as a historian. But I like their approach. You know, I like that they have that kind of like museum mode when you like can just walk around and see stuff instead of, you know, having to kill people, which is a big part of the regular game. So I think there's a lot of educational possibilities in that series. But there's a whole range of games that I think could make for very interesting, teachable moments as a historian.
Yeah. Now, my last question for you, we just talked about the maybe Red Dead Redemption 3 would have, you know, Mormon settlers, but I want to hear your pitch. What do you think should be the focus of Red Dead Redemption 3?
Yeah, totally. So actually, the epilogue of my book presents my vision for what Red Dead 3 should be. And I don't expect that any writers or developers at Rockstar will listen to me or read it. I mean, if they do, that's great. But so I really think that the series should continue its backward motion in time, right? Because Red Dead 1 is set in 1911, Red Dead 2 in 1899. I want to see Red Dead 3 in like 1872. And the reason why I think so, maybe like, let's say finding Arthur Morgan or Hosea or, I don't know, some other character, you know, like at, you know, like 18 or 19 years old or something like that. And the reason I suggest this is because throughout the book, I argue that Rockstar really wanted to make a game about the early 1870s in making Red Dead Redemption 2. However, that game is set in 1899, and so many of the topics that were very true for the 1870s actually make no sense in 1899. But going to hunt bison, for example, discovering the Klan in the woods, open warfare between native peoples and the government, that's very much happening in 1872. Very much not happening in 1899. Like, they're practically impossible, in fact. So I think Rockstar is really drawing on a lot of 1870s events. So in Red Dead 3, why not actually set the game in that decade? Because in many ways, that decade is much more wild, quote unquote, than the 1890s, certainly in the West, given that there was no sense that, you know, the U.S. Army was going to win its wars against native people. Native peoples were pushing back army regiments and winning battles left and right. I mean, the you know, there's very much a sense of uncertainty there. But then, you know, maybe even wilder than the South in 1872 is wilder than the West in 1872 is the South, right? Because this is in the midst of Reconstruction. U.S. troops are occupying a great deal of the region. There is, you know, tremendous bloodshed between white supremacist paramilitaries like the Ku Klux Klan and others, and black freed people, in addition to white Republicans who sympathized with the freed people. So there's like so much chaos and turmoil at that moment. I think a third game that really engages thoughtfully and respectfully with the chaos of that time period would make for an amazing game and another amazing way to share the sort of real history and the real historical dilemmas of that time period. So if any Rockstar writers and developers are listening or read the book, you should do that. Yeah. It would be a great game.
Yeah.
If you need a consultant, I will consider it.
My contribution to your pitch would be make it about Dutch Vanderlyn and the rise of Dutch. And it ends with he meets Arthur Morgan and they come to Blackwater, and then credits. We know how that all goes if you played Red Dead Redemption 2.
Yeah,
all right.
I think that could all happen in an 1870s context. Right?
Yeah, why not? All right. Tori Olson's book, Red Dead's History, a Video Game and Obsession and America's Violent Past, is on sale now. Tori, thank you so much.
Let me add one thing, though.
Of course.
Connor, one thing we haven't mentioned is that the audiobook of Red Dead's History is especially cool because the audiobook is narrated by none other than Roger Clark, who played Arthur Morgan in the game. And if you listen to just a clip, a sample of what this sounds like, you'll find that Roger's voice is a very familiar one because, well, I'll say no more than that. But let's say he leans into his Western cowboy voice in doing the book. So if you want to spend 10 and a half hours more with Roger Clark, knowing that, you know, Arthur's story is over at this point, since, spoiler alert, he does not survive Red Dead Redemption 2, then Red Dead's History can be a way to continue the journey in a sense. I mean, it's not a video game, but it will discuss. It's very fun listening to Roger Clark quoting Arthur Morgan, because I quote Arthur a lot in the book, and then he's doing the narration in the same voice, right? So it's pretty fascinating. So wanted to, any listeners who were thinking about listening to the book rather than reading it, that is a big added bonus.
All right, you heard it here. Whatever you're listening to this podcast on, go ahead and purchase the audiobook so you can hear that. I know I'm going to do that. That's awesome. I did not know that. That's incredible.
Oh, you didn't know that? That's
no, crazy. I did not. Oh, man.
I think this book is being listened to rather than read more frequently because of the amazing narrator that we got.
Oh, lucky, lucky, lucky. All right, Tori, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, pleasure. Thanks for inviting me, Connor.